Hello and welcome to this special episode of the Decarceration Nation podcast. Today I'm interviewing Bill Cobbs, who's running for governor as a Democrat here in Michigan. Thanks for being here, Mr. Cobbs.
Josh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So the first question I think everyone I'm going to ask you, I think I would ask anybody, is what made you decide to run for governor in Michigan?
Well, like you and probably so many people out there listening today, I know that we have an opportunity to make Michigan better. And frankly, I didn't see anybody standing up to do that. So, you know, if you want something done, you got to get in a fight and do it yourself.
So, great answer. And do you mind sharing a little bit of your history and what brought you to this point?
Sure. well, you know, I graduated from Cass Technical High School in 1970. When I graduated from Cass Tech, I enrolled in the University of Michigan. My folks and I had enough money for 1 year. When that money ran out, I enlisted in the United States Navy. When I was in the Navy, I was lucky enough to be selected for the Navy Boost Program, broadened opportunities for officer selection and training. That program allowed me to return to U of M to finish my undergrad education. Once I had done that, I returned to the Navy. So I got to see the Navy both as an enlisted guy and then later as an officer. When I finished my naval service, I had gotten admitted to Wayne State University Law School, came home to go to law school, needed a job to help pay for it, so I was a Detroit cop for 4 years while I was in law school. And many times I was the first on the scene when needless gun violence had occurred. After finishing law school, I went to work for Xerox Corporation, starting at the very bottom, and over the course of my career, I rose to be the Global Vice President for Public Sector for the U.S., Canada, Latin America, and Europe. We started that division with, I met my wife Lisa while we were at the University of Michigan, and we've been a team for the last 38 years. I have two adult children, Will and Brooke, and a very precocious four-year-old granddaughter, Kennedy.
Congratulations.
And the reason I'm running for governor is we fundamentally have an opportunity now to get Michigan back on track. And that's what I wanted, get us back on track.
So you say that you'd like for us to get back on track, and you mentioned that you went to high school in Detroit, mm-hmm. and that you worked as a police officer in Detroit. What do you see that needs to be fixed in Detroit to get us back on track?
Well, you know, one of the things that makes Detroit kind of a boilerplate for what's happening in our country is so much of what is being done to bring the city back now is not focused on neighborhoods, it's not focused on people, it's focused on big business and corporations. You know, we had a bill passed in the Senate last year, Senate Bill 242, that now allows people like Dan Gilbert to get massive tax breaks for the next 25 years at the expense of the citizens who will have to pick up the slack. We can't continue to try and operate our state and our cities based upon our citizens bearing the brunt of what it costs to maintain basic services.
Yeah, regressive taxation, in other words, has become a pretty big problem in a lot of ways. So one area where I've noticed this recently that's affected a lot of the state is water. As everybody's probably aware, the state of Michigan just decided to stop providing bottled water to the residents of Flint during the same week when a story came out that said that lead levels were still high when they did tests in the area's schools. Do you have any feelings about what's going on in Flint?
Well, you know, today I sent a letter to the governor. And the premise of that letter was that it was absolutely wrong to approve an increase in the amount of water that Nestle is able to take out of the state of Michigan at the same time where we have citizens in Flint who remain afraid to drink their local water supply because of what was done to them. I also talked in my letter about conditions in Detroit where we're cutting people off from water and creating the possibility for communicable disease like Shigella and hepatitis, all in the name of revenue. We got to use some common sense, and we can't. How in good conscience can we say that we're going to let Nestle take millions of gallons of water for a $200 permit, and we're going to shut ordinary citizens off. So we need a water and environmental policy that makes sense for our citizens. We can't continue this pathway that we have right now to continue to enrich corporations on the backs of people who can least afford it.
One of the reasons I was really happy to hear that you wanted to talk is that I saw you in a forum, and I thought that one of the things you did a really good job of in comparison to a lot of the other candidates was not just promise a chicken in every pot. So yes, I if you've ever followed me, know that I'm very passionate about both the Flint and the Detroit water situations. So what is your solution to this?
So I've said, as the governor of the state, I'm prepared to spend every single penny that we have in our state rainy day fund to alleviate the situation in Flint. Because, you know, if we don't see the Flint water crisis as a rainy day, we'll never have a rainy day in Michigan. You know, the governor consistently wants to tell citizens about the fact that we almost have $1 billion in a rainy day fund, but we don't spend it in emergencies like Flint. And it concerns me, because Flint really should be the canary in the coal mine for every single Michigan citizen. You know, what happened in Flint can happen in any city in our state. And if we're not prepared to address it, then we're really creating a terrible, terrible future for ourselves. You know, Flint only had 16,000 lead service lines. 4 years later, we still haven't replaced half of them. Now, if we had that same kind of tragedy happen in Detroit, where we have 120,000 lead service lines and a water system that services every community for a 50-mile radius, you know, we're not talking about a tragedy. We're talking about something that's a catastrophe on a huge scale that we would be decades recovering from. We can't do that.
Yeah, I agree, and I apologize for the chimes. We're actually recording this in a friend's house today, so there might be a few interesting noises, but bear with us. So part of, as what everyone who listens to this podcast knows, that we generally talk about criminal justice reform. But I feel like a lot of these issues, like water, start with the development of how kids develop. A lot of the kids who are exposed to lead, that probably has some effect on their cognition as they grow up. And there can be bad outcomes from that, both mental health outcomes and just generally how they integrate into society. Another area where that is important is our public schools. And I've read enough of what you've had to say to know that we have a similar position on kind of what's happened to the Detroit public schools. So would you mind talking about that for a few minutes?
So we have been running our schools since 1994 under Proposal A, which called for state funding of approximately $7,500 to $8,100 per student. The problem with that is that there are communities in Michigan that are allowed to have public millages that allow them to provide much, much more for their students. You have huge disparities in what we're delivering for public education. You know, it can range from $8,000 on the low end to $14,000 or $15,000 on the high end. How can we say that we expect the same kind of educational outcomes consistently across the state when we have such huge disparities? So I want to move us away from what Proposal A called for and do state equalized funding to the tune of $11,500 a year per kid, because we know that we've been underfunding public education in this state for a very, very long time. And, you know, this notion that school of choice and that charter schools are filling the gap is just nonsense, because there's no empirical data whatsoever to support the notion that charter schools have done a better job of delivering education to our children. And furthermore, they've proven to be problematic in the respect that oftentimes these private for profit charters, you know, when they can't make the kind of money that they wanted to make, have folded up their tents and walked away in the middle of a school year. We can't put our children at that kind of jeopardy. You know, so I've said as an ex-governor of the state, we're going to do something fundamentally different. We won't be able to outlaw charter schools, but we can certainly defund them and cut off the stream of public dollars going to support them. You know, they're in the business of making a profit. And I don't have a problem with them making a profit. They're just not going to make it off our citizens. You know, they're going to be, we're going to place them on the same level as any parochial school that raises its money by getting people to pay tuition. Secondly, we're going to do something novel. We're going to regulate charter schools. We're not going to allow them to operate on a different set of rules than we do our public schools. You know, we have created, we've literally created a monster that's eating up public education in the state. You know, one of the things I know coming from Detroit is that in 1965, Detroit had approximately 300 public schools. In 1999, it still had 199. Today, Detroit has less than 80 public schools. Now, if you ride through that city and you look at neighborhoods where the schools are no longer there, they look like they're in battlefields. You have house after house after house that is vacant and boarded up and in many instances exposed to the elements and now on the city land bank list of properties to be torn down. We're tearing properties down that could be used at a cost of $25,000 a house. Why aren't we making those homes available to the folks that can't afford houses for a dollar? And instead of spending $25,000 to tear them down, giving them grants for $25,000 to rehabilitate those properties. That's what you do to attack the core problem that ultimately leads people to the penitentiary. We talk, you know, ad nauseum in this country about doing something to alleviate the school-to-prison pipeline. If we're not willing to attack the root cause, and the root cause is always poverty, if we're not prepared to attack poverty, then we're never going to fix this problem.
So since we're kind of in this area, there's a proposal right now to do what's called raise the age, which ultimately means that people who are 17 are no longer presumptively tried as adults. Do you have any feelings about raise the age or similar legislation?
I think that's a start, but I think fundamentally we've got to look at our entire criminal justice system and process and look at major reform. You know, one of the things that I've said is that I would do as the next governor of this state is fundamentally break glass. And the first step in breaking that glass is we have got to get away from the notion that we send first-time offenders of a non-criminal nature to a penitentiary. What we're doing is literally taking people who could still be productive members of society and sending them to Gladiator College and expecting that we're going to have positive outcome. So I would put a bracelet on them, send them home so they can still go to work and take care of their families, and create the opportunity for them to continue to have a normal life. Because let's face it, in the society that we live in today, anybody can make a mistake. We can't continue this mentality that if somebody makes a mistake or does something that's inappropriate, that we forever taint them in their ability to be a useful, productive member of society.
So you're talking about kind of a more general diversion program for anyone who's a first-time offender. Do you also agree with ideas in diversion for people with mental health problems so that they go in a more mental health direction as opposed to a criminal direction?
Absolutely. One of the things that we absolutely have to do here in Michigan is reconstitute the state mental health department and stop this notion of believing that by privatizing it, that we're delivering a more appropriate level of service. Right now in Michigan, we don't have a single mental health hospital. You know, we're leaving that up to our police. Police aren't equipped or prepared to deal with folks that have mental health problems. And what we literally do by forcing people that have mental health issues in the criminal justice system is create a revolving door. They're in, they're out, they're in, they're out. And it's not working. We got to be more intelligent about the way we attack this problem.
So one of the big, you'll frequently hear people talk about diversion for people with mental health problems, as long as they didn't also commit a criminal act mm-hmm. in relation to that. What you don't hear a lot about is the state of criminal health within our prisons and jails. Having seen that firsthand and, you know, talked about it on this podcast quite a bit, that's a very important issue to me. I wonder if you've thought about that at all.
You know, what I know is that we don't really treat people who are incarcerated. What we do is medicate them. And we use medication as a substitute for delivering the kind of real services that they need to really attack the underlying issues. If all we do with somebody who's incarcerated, who has mental health issues, is suppress the underlying causes of that behavior, then we haven't done anything. You know, what we've done is we've made it easier for the folks who are charged with taking care of them behind bars to have an easier task. But when we turn them loose again on the public, we haven't prepared them or society for really dealing with their issues.
So one of the really big issues that we're having in prisons and jails right now may sound like a small thing, but there's really two related issues. The first one is there's a company that has, because they wanted to maintain their patent, created a strip form of a drug called Suboxone. Mm-hmm. And the end result of that is that it's very easy to smuggle in mail. It can be masked very easily on the outside or the inside of an envelope. And what's happened is the Michigan Department of Corrections has changed their policy for sending mail so that it is virtually impossible to not mess up one of the requirements. I remember when we were doing Christmas cards, sending Christmas cards to inmates, we had a checklist that we had right by us, and it was taking us 20 minutes to write one card.
Wow.
Kids, for instance, children of inmates, can't send their parents, you know, crayon or, you know, anything like that. There's a lot of restrictions. And there are even people in the women's facility right next to us here at Huron Valley that say that they're getting, you know, sometimes it takes up to 2 months to get their mail. And people will tell you they've sent mail and they don't ever get it because it didn't meet the requirements. It's not like the MDOC is going to write you back and tell you that your mail got thrown out. One of the problems, the reason this happens, is because we have a mail system in the prisons that's disaggregated. All the different facilities kind of do their own mail, mm-hmm. and they can't afford to have a machine to test at every single one of the facilities. But it seems to me that a centralized facility with one machine that checks all the mail first might make this better. Does that sound persuasive at all to you?
It does, but I think that we've got to, in addition to looking at things like that, we've got to look at the way we incarcerate people in this country and ask ourselves a fundamental question. Is the methodology, the approach that we use to incarceration, really serving our best interest? When you compare conditions in one of our prisons with something that would be in a European facility like a Sweden or Denmark or one of those countries, it's like night and day. You know, if we want people to become a part of our society again, we've got to treat them the way that we expect them to behave. If we treat them like animals, if we put them in facilities where they're, you know, in a cage with bars, they're going to do whatever they have to do to make sure that they have money for commissary. You know, one of the reasons people smuggle things into prison is so that they have something to barter with, because we create a situation where, you know, somebody may be working in a prison industry, but they're only getting $1.50 a day. You know,
what's that?
they can't afford to buy basic necessities, and they're responsible for their own basic necessities. So we create this catch-22 ourselves. Now, the question is, do we have the intelligence and the integrity to go about fixing our own problem? Or are we more interested in creating a recycled industry that focuses on people?
Well, I think it's interesting that you say the word industry, because I think one of the real problems is that, and I talk to legislators a lot about these issues, is that there's kind of no benefit to being anything but tough on crime politically, as a general rule. And so when people are willing to get on board, it seems like they're most willing to get on board with very minor reforms so that they can appear to both be tough on crime and to be involved in criminal justice reform. So as governor, how would you deal with a legislator that's not always on board for seriously rethinking, for instance, our system of mass incarceration?
I think one of the things that the next governor of the state is going to have is the courage to be able to call people up by name. You know, all too often, we have folks who go to Lansing or go to Washington, and they're more focused on creating collegial relationships than they are with getting people to do the right things. So the governor has got to be somebody who's comfortable not necessarily being friends with everybody, but getting the work of the people done. You know, when we talk about the penal system in the country and, you know, flowing down to the states, more and more every single year, it's becoming a privatized industry. And when you think about the fact that it's a business, I've never seen a business yet that wants to put itself out of business. You know, we got to get smarter about this, because we can't create this opportunity for people to make money off the backs of individuals and families to the extent that it tears the fabric of the foundation of our country. And that's what it's doing.
So we were talking before we started recording about bail.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if you had any thoughts about the cash bail system.
Well, the cash bail system is not designed to serve the needs of regular, ordinary, working class people. You know, it's unfortunate that we live in a country where you get as much justice as you can afford. You know, the number of people in this country, innocent people, who are forced to take plea deals because they can't afford an attorney, because they can't afford the kind of representation it would take to free them, is horrendous. We got a bail system that says that for XYZ crime, we're going to institute a bail policy that says that you got to put up $1 million. Well, if you got $100 million, $1 million isn't anything. But if you come from a family that maybe makes $30,000-$35,000 a year, giving you $1 million bail is like saying, you know, we're going to stick in here. We don't care. So we've got to be more cognizant of resources than, you know, just focusing on a dollar amount. Bail systems inherently have flaws in them. You know, one of those flaws is that those that can afford to pay them get out. Those that can't afford to pay them don't get out. And there's no empirical data today that supports the notion that poor people flee from the bail system more so than rich people. You know, it's an inequitable application of the law.
Yeah. On that one, you're definitely singing to the choir. Is there... So another issue is kind of related to one of the things we talked about before, mostly in jails, but there's some creep of this into other areas. We've had a phenomenon where companies like Securus,
mm-hmm,
have started to create video visitation systems, and to save themselves money, jails have basically shut off in-person visits. And the research pretty overwhelmingly describes that in-person visits are very important to the health and the outcomes that we're looking for in terms of what happens when inmates are released, for instance, seeing your kid or seeing your wife or whatever. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts about this kind of move. I mean, we have this problem in Washtenaw County.
Well, it's wrong, because literally what we're doing is we're turning facility after facility into a supermax for people that don't require that level of supervision, you know, and we're doing it because it's more cost effective for private enterprise, and we're totally disregarding the importance of maintaining familial relationships have for folks who are incarcerated. You know, when we incarcerate somebody for 10 years, On average, we'll find that over 50% of those inmates, by the time they get to the 10th year, literally have no contact with their outside family members because they've gotten frustrated and it's just not a part of their day-to-day activity. And we can't be part of the problem. We got to be part of the solution.
Another kind of related issue is we've gotten to the point where we talked about regressive taxation or de facto regressive taxation mm-hmm. earlier. And one thing that's really been happening across the country, but also very much in Michigan, is the notion that prisoners and prisoners' families should bear the brunt of most of the costs, or at least what possible costs can be borne for their incarceration. And so we have these fines and fees that get attached. For instance, you know, I mean, just to use myself as an example, when I got out just in terms of court fees, you know, I think it was over $6,000. And when you are earning, as you mentioned earlier, like a dollar a day inside, and they don't let you keep any of the money you had before, I'm still curious as what kind of outcomes they're expecting when people come out with tens of thousands of dollars in debt, no employment, and a gigantic bill.
Which is clearly one of the reasons why we should be looking for a sentencing structure that makes more sense. You know, if we put somebody behind bars for years and years and years, and on top of their incarceration, we're taxing them with paying the state back, we are literally killing any opportunity that they have to build a life once they get out. Because if you get out of prison and you owe the state $100,000, and you are lucky enough to find a job that just pays basic subsistence, how do you ever get that off your back? It's impossible. You know, so we've got to either adhere to the notion that once you pay your debt, you've paid your debt, or we've got to admit that that's not really what incarceration is about in this country. You know, right now, what it's about is permanently branding somebody and saying, okay, you know, your sentence is X, but oh, by the way, you're going to carry that X for the rest of your life. You know, every time you go to look for a job, every time you go to look for a bank loan, every time you try and do the right thing and re-enter the system, we're going to tag you.
And the irony, of course, is that, you know, overwhelmingly, again, the research shows that the three biggest reasons that people recidivate are lack of a good job, lack of a place to sleep,
right,
and lack of community connection. Right. When you add shame and all of the barriers, you're adding to all of that. So one of my working theories for a long time has been that we should look at prison like a hospital looks at a patient, that the minute they arrive, they should be in the process of planning for a successful return. Right.
Well, you look at countries like Sweden and Denmark and Norway, they have the lowest recidivism rates in the world. That's because once somebody has gone through that experience and been able to avail themselves of the systems and opportunities that they can take advantage of behind bars, they don't return. They don't return. We, on the other hand, create, and I call them gladiator colleges because that's what they are. We create gladiator colleges, and then we're surprised when people come up out of those things 10 times harder than they ever went in, and so cynical about taking the approach of trying to reintegrate into society that they just go out and do something else. Because that's what comes natural to them. We taught them that. They didn't. It's not something that came natural to them. We taught it to them.
And we also don't provide them with a lot of alternatives.
Right.
I think is a lot
that's
of,
right.
Yeah. So I know that part of your background is being a police officer in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And I guess a good place to kind of close the circle on this criminal justice thing is to ask how that's informed your approach that you've described today to how you look at people who are charged of crimes.
So one of the most important things that I learned when I was a cop was that if you treat people the way you want to be treated, it's a lot less stressful on everybody. You know, I often found when I was a cop that when people took a hostile stance with you and you were able to maintain your composure, it quickly de-escalated and created an opportunity for you to have a real exchange. Because if people can't get you to rise to the occasion and you can, you know, keep things on an even level, then they quickly come down to an even level. You know, I think when I look at police work in this country, we have some real opportunities to make for meaningful change. One of those meaningful changes has got to be having officers understand that when they interact with a citizen, they literally set the tone. And the tone that they choose to take is what generally escalates situations out of control. You know, if you recognize that any exchange that you have with a police officer, you know, that doesn't start with a smile, is one that's going to be fraught with all kinds of possible negative implications, then you haven't learned anything. And I think that's an opportunity for us as a society to do a better job when we're taking young officers through training to help them understand basic sensitivity issues, basic appreciations for cultural issues that they'll encounter every day. You know, I think if I remember correctly, we spent less than in my, I think it was 10 weeks in the academy, we spent less than 2 days on those kind of issues. We're not preparing officers properly to interact with people. And we create a very insular approach to dealing with citizens. It becomes us against them. It doesn't matter what kind of citizen it is, it's always going to be us against them. And that's not working out well for us.
So, last thing I'll ask you, I really appreciate you doing this, is what else do you want people to know about your campaign and why they should vote for Bill Cobbs?
Well, what I want them to know is that this is not Bill Cobbs' campaign. This is their campaign. This is an opportunity for them to have someone who really works for them and doesn't work for big business and doesn't work for special interests. You know, people have asked me a million times, why do I want to be governor? We have reached, I think, a tipping point in this country where we've got to fundamentally decide what it is we're going to be. If we continue down the path we're on now, we're headed in a very, very bad direction. We've got to have people in government who are working for public policy that's driven from a citizen's perspective rather than anything else. Who's not looking for the next donor who can help them to get reelected. You know, I'm fortunate enough to say that I'm running not because I need a job, because I don't need a job, not to do anything to stroke my ego, but because it's important to me that we create the opportunity for every young person in this country, no matter what zip code they were born or raised in, to have a good opportunity for a good life. And if we do that, I think that overall we will come out of it a better people.
Thanks so much to Bill Cobbs for sitting down for the interview. And thanks to you all for listening to this special edition of Decarceration Nation. Decarceration Nation is available from iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are aggregated. We're also now available on Spotify.